The stories of Tapaia and Omai and their vital roles as Captain Cook's unsung shipmates. Do you know much about the unsung shipmates and their roles on board Captain Cook's Endeavour? Well, it's about time that we learnt more about Cook's travels to put his achievements into proper context to help shed light on what is a largely one-sided knowledge of this history in his senior lecturer in modern history at Macquarie University, Kate Fulliger. Welcome to Evenings, Kate.
Thank you so much. It's great to be on here, Christine.
So, Kate, tell us about what you do in your role at the Modern History Department and what got you interested in history?
Well, my role at Macquarie is to teach. I basically teach second year undergraduates and I also teach some master's graduates. Interestingly, I teach I teach kind of broad surveys driven generally by popular demand, which actually turns out to be kind of European history or British Empire history. I would prefer to teach things like Pacific history, which is my real research passion. The way that I kind of get that into my teaching, though, is to, you know, run big courses, big surveys of the British Empire, and actually show that Indigenous peoples and colonised peoples actually made that history dynamic. It actually gives the energy behind imperial history, and most importantly, it kind of it shows ways that empire ends in the end because of Indigenous actions. So that's how I actually bring in my research passions into my undergraduate teaching.
Well, what did you were you educated in Australia? What did you feel about the teachings of history in Australia?
Yes, I was very lucky. I did my undergraduate work at Australian National University with a lot of really dynamic, fantastic teachers, and I am Australian. But I did do my postgraduate work in the United States at Berkeley, which was a great opportunity to see historians come from all over the world to a place like Berkeley. But it actually underscored to me that the whole discipline of history, even despite the best will of teachers, the whole discipline of history is sometimes kind of geared towards only Western interpretations. And particularly when we get to a field like the exploration of our part of the world, I think the emphasis on only seeing the kind of European advent or kind of the Western intrusion as the main part of the story can be really quite overwhelming. So I've always been interested in adding in the context, which of course was always there. It was there before Europeans. It's always been there through the European era as well. And of course it remains just as dynamic as it always has been.
Dynamic yet underplayed.
Underplayed.
Underdocumented.
Yep. Underdocumented, partly because I think of just the nature of history itself. It's a very Western discipline. Partly, of course, also by the interests of certain kind of settler governments around the world who will jump on the opportunity, say, of a Cook celebration to think about Cook. I think actually interesting in this year, partly I think because of the coronavirus interruption, but also because of some due planning. A lot of experts have tried to kind of push back against maybe typical Cook celebration and given it a really interesting edge. And a lot of experts, a lot of historians and commentators have jumped in to show that there are actually multiple aspects to this story. And Cook himself becomes so much more interesting when we can think about him in a context of an Indigenous world.
So what do we know about what has been documented about the Indigenous people who journeyed with James Cook?
So the people who were with him, I mean, they actually got onto the Endeavour and then the later ship's Resolution and the Adventure and so on. We do know quite a lot about them in terms of most of the officers will comment about them. In the case of Omai, or Mai as he's called from his homelands, he was on the second Cook voyage. He actually made it all the way to Britain and lived in Britain for 2 years. Because of that experience, he actually learnt quite a lot of English and could communicate. So a lot of kind of evidence of his communications is written down as well, even though it's not by his own hand. And of course, we also are quite fortunate in that 2 years worth of British observers, who people were fascinated by him, also wrote down their impressions of him. So we have more than I think people would expect sources on someone like Omai. Tapaia, someone else I've written about recently, was also from the Tahitian archipelago, and he was on Cook's first voyage. He unfortunately died before making it to Britain, which had been his aim. But again, quite a lot of officers write about his experience on the Endeavour. And importantly, also another story that's, I think, only recently come to Australian audiences, is that a lot of Maori people in New Zealand who also encountered Tupaia through the Endeavour voyage have oral histories, oral remembrances of Tupaia, and have stories to tell about Tupaia. And I think historians of Cook or of the West are increasingly interested to hear about those oral histories and realise that's just as good a source as a whole bunch of other pieces of evidence that we have.
You're right about how the Indigenous people actually then, because of how dynamic who they were and what they did, they do make James Cook seem much more interesting, because he was quite intrigued by that priest, Tupaia. He documented a lot of his stories and things that he did.
That's right. Yeah. No, I think there's lots of evidence to show that the two of them work as co-navigators through many periods of that Endeavour voyage, from when Cook picks him up from the Tahitian archipelago. They go down to New Zealand first, or Aotearoa, come over to Kamei, today's Botany Bay. They go up the Barrier Reef together, and then they go over to kind of what we call today Jakarta, where unfortunately Tupaia died, probably of malaria. But all the way through that navigation, particularly when he's going through the Pacific from Tahiti to New Zealand, he's clearly communicating a whole bunch of navigational data to Cook. Some might say that because he's actually even been there himself. So there's a lot of suggestion that he knows so much about the islands between Tahiti and New Zealand that he himself had done some kind of voyaging or knew ancestral stories about that kind of voyaging.
Yeah. I read something somewhere and it made me think how clever he was, because he said he was just probably just trying to visit all these islands that he used to get into his canoe and go and visit. And this was just a much easier way to do it.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. I mean, to think in a waka kind of, Polynesian canoe to go all the way from Tahiti to New Zealand and back for one person is just an absolute epic journey that just kind of boggles my mind. But certainly his ancestors had done it in part, of course, many times. To think that Tupaia himself had done it is very, very intriguing. And I think partly where research is going at the moment to think about how might this have been done by one individual.
Yeah. So we don't know much about the islander who journeyed the longest with Cook, Mai, because he sort of had a kind of a political understory.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I've just written a book that's really focused more on Omai than on Tupaia. So Omai was the one who went with Cook's second voyage. And what people have mostly said about him or thought about him was the, 2 years that he had made a huge splash in Britain. And you can sort of imagine, if you are interested in British history, then seeing Britain, 18th century Britain, through the eyes of a Pacific Islander can be intriguing, and it has kind of grabbed a lot of historians' imaginations. But I think because it's captured the imagination so much that people actually haven't paid enough attention to his own island story. And probably the way that I've kind of, the kind of conclusion I came up with when I studied Omai a lot more, was to think that for him personally, those 2 years in Britain were just, interesting but not completely life-defining chapter in his life. Really, the defining aspects of his life had happened earlier for him, when he'd been kind of ousted with his whole family from Raiatea, which is just to the west of Tahiti, and he'd become a refugee with his family in Tahiti because of a kind of inter-Indigenous war that had been going on in that archipelago. And he'd grown up from a teenager in Tahiti, quite respected, because Raiateans carry a kind of very high respect amongst all Polynesian islands, but, always, I think, burning with a sense of anger and determination to go back to his island home, Raiatea. And when you see when you imagine him meeting Cook with that kind of background in mind, you can see that what he sees in Cook is an opportunity perhaps to, make friends, get some alms perhaps from these, you know, travellers who seem to be coming and then going, in order to enact his interest in retaining Raiatea, right? His ambition is not to go to Britain and meet King George and, you know, hang out in London society. That's just a side effect. What he really wants to do is to refocus his energies back on his own Indigenous life.
Isn't it interesting? Because King George III was really, really fascinated by him. All the British people were bedazzled by this really unique person. But he didn't care. He just wanted to get back to his island home.
I think that's probably, that's as far as I've got. I mean, I really tried to, in an earlier book, I'd been actually one of those historians who had been quite fascinated by the 2 years he spent in Britain. And it's actually in my second book that I realised really maybe the more intriguing story is how those 2 years were, you know, just a minor part. And the real drama for him, from a Pacific perspective, was, you know, the other 30 years of his life, where he was really kind of determined to try and use Europeans, use imperial tools for his own personal benefit, which is to try and think about his family reclaiming their land in Raiatea. So, Omai's endlessly interesting to me. I don't think, I mean, we know this story, or I've kind of pieced together this story because of the evidence we have from the British officers who met him. So bits and pieces in those journals suggest that they realise, you know, he does have a complex family background. That's why he wants to join them. That's why he wants to go to Britain. He talks about Raiatea a lot. So it's only when you kind of add up all these little lines everywhere through the officer journals, then you realise actually maybe this is the full story. But very often, even the officers themselves forget that background, and they say that there's an assumption, oh, Omai is just, you know, he thinks that we're a novelty, we think that he's a novelty. It's all just, you know, a superficial type of trip, you know, it's not particularly meaningful other than some sort of adventure in the exotic, right? So often the officers seem to forget that actually Omai had just as serious political ambition as Britain itself did in the Pacific.
I understand that Joseph Banks takes in Omai, looks
That's
after
right.
him, gives him board, and then on his return journey that was captained by another captain, not Cook, down through Tasmania, he's got cattle, and or Cook gives all the cattle away and also says that he's going to make allies with other people and then dumps him on an island. And it's recorded that he's crying like a baby when Cook leaves.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, you've got a lot of the story there. That's right. So so Banks is the one who had, on the very first Endeavour voyage, wanted to kind of bring Tupaia to Britain. And he had a passion for this kind of experiment of bringing people across the world and observing.
So Tupaia is the priest that passes away in Jakarta, modern day Jakarta.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. So because he died, and Banks wasn't on that second voyage, but he kind of told Cook, if you can get someone like that to Britain, then I will look after him. And that is what happened. And so when Omai arrives in London, then Banks becomes the chaperone for pretty much the whole 2 years. Yes, and it's true. And I think that Banks did probably figure out what Omai really wanted, which was leverage, whatever leverage he might be able to gain from the British, so arms and maybe support for his kind of Raiatean restitution plan.
Because the war with the Raiateans was against the Bora Borans.
That's right, yeah. So Bora Borans had kind of another island, again to the further west, had come in through Mai's childhood and taken over his island. Mm. And so he'd fled, they'd all fled to Tahiti as refugees. So that was his game plan. And it looks like Banks had probably figured that out. And he does try to secure Mai some arms that he wants as parting gifts from Britain. But he also throws in some sort of pretty stupid gifts as well, because he's just kind of slightly, yeah, he has a kind of perverse sense of humour, I think. So he throws in weird things like an umbrella or a set of crockery.
I'd like an umbrella. There's something about that that I'd really like, because it gets really hot and it's a shade and it protects you from the rain. So I don't know. I think Omai would have liked all of that stuff.
I think you probably would have appreciated it in London. I think it's maybe not so useful in Tahiti when you've when you have to kind of deal with little showers all the time. But he may have actually selected out some funny souvenirs for himself with Banks. It's a bit unclear about that. But what is clear is that Banks understands, and he tells the Admiralty this, and the Admiralty also understands, that Maumai wants to be delivered back on Raiatea. That is the island, right, to go to, not to some other one. And Cook does know that. Well, the instructions to say, deposit him at the island of his choosing. And we all know that it's Raiatea. But yes, as you've suggested, from about Tasmania all the way up to north to Tahiti, Mai is realizing that Cook maybe has some other priorities than Mai's own wishes here. He looks like he's giving away a lot of the livestock that Mai had his eye on that he wanted. He realizes also that Cook is, you know, doing deals with certain island elders about maybe taking in Omai, which Omai does have no interest in being in those particular islands. So there is evidence that Omai is becoming a bit sort of nervous about Cook's kind of good faith through the last leg of that journey. And in the end, he's right that Cook decides that Raiatea, because as you've said, there's a war going on, is just too volatile for him to enter into. He doesn't want anything to do with this island politics. So he leaves Omai instead at a different island again called Huaheine, which he thinks is going to be nice and peaceful. And he thinks, right, I've done my duty. That's all I needed to do by the Admiralty. I think once we know the backstory of Omai, once we keep that in mind, of course it becomes so much more obvious why Omai would burst into tears at this point. And it's fascinating to me how many historians have read those tears as, oh, it must have been a sign that he was so attached to the British and, you know, wanted to kind of be with the British and maybe go home again to Britain, because that's how a lot of the officers read it. But I think when we think of what he really wanted and why he'd even gone on the journey in the first place, which by this stage was 4 years beforehand.
He betrayed him.
That he was just really crying for another reason. He's really crying because his whole big world plan had failed in this moment.
And this is this the fatal journey for Cook?
The voyage? Yes, that's right, the third one, that's right. The one that he returns Omai on is after Tahiti, he goes to Hawaii. And that is where he meets his fate. And, you know, some historians, I feel like I've always traced the stories of people like Tupaia and Omai more carefully than I have Cook. But the historians that I do read on Cook kind of do suggest that his temperament is probably fraying through that third voyage. He may well have been the calm and ordered man of the Enlightenment through some earlier voyages in his life. It never ever stopped random acts of violence, though, from his voyages. But those violent moments increased through the third voyage, and were his undoing, actually, in the end in Hawaii.
I'd spend 5 minutes on the ocean, and that would, do me in. I'd be done. Kate, I've really enjoyed the chat tonight. Thank you so much for joining us for Black Life Matters.
Thank you so much. It's a real thrill to talk to you. I've been a long admirer.
Oh, thank you so much. I wish all the women in your life and yourself, if you're a mum, a happy Mother's Day for Sunday.
Thanks so much. Yes, I'll enjoy it.
You're listening to ABC Radio's Weekend Evenings. I'm Christine Arnoux, and we were just talking with author Kate Fulliger, who has some incredible stories of Priest Tupaia and Omai, navigators and translators who are aboard the ship Endeavour, including details of their vital roles as Captain Cook's unsung shipmates.